Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
This is the Get Booked Podcast, a weekly show for personalized reading recommendations. This is episode 318, and we're recording on February 15th. I'm Jen Worthington. I'm here with Amanda Nelson, and we are coming to you from Book Riot, and it is Tired Tuesday
it
over
is.
Here.
Yes.
Hopefully we're more awake by Thursday when you're listening to this. We'll see.
It now takes me days to recover from a thing. Like, I watched the Super Bowl, which I did not, there was not imbibement to excess or anything like that because I'm too old for that also. But I stayed up like an hour past my normal bedtime.
Yeah.
And here on Tuesday, I'm still not from like, I went to bed at 10 and I'm still too tired.
I've been staying up super late to watch some of the Olympics and it is, I'm going to be feeling that for like a month.
This is just how it is.
Team old. All right, here we go. Well, aside from when we're complaining about life, this is a book recommendation show, we swear. That means you can send in your requests for a reading recommendation and we might answer it on the show. You can send those in either via email, getbooked@bookriot.com, or you can send them in through the form and the show notes on the site. And it can be for you. Maybe there's like a certain kind of book that you love. It can be for a book club, a family member, a friend, a trip, whatever. And if it's a time-sensitive request, please put time sensitive, and then the date you're hoping to hear back by, either in the subject line of the email or the very first line of the form. We'll try. We'll see what happens. Let's see. We have some feedback. We have a bunch of feedback today. All right. Laura says, for the person who wanted histotainment, they might like Byzantium by Stephen Lawhead. A monk from the British Isles is trying to get to Byzantium and runs or sails into a lot of issues on the way. Suzanne says, for the reader who wanted historical baseball fiction, there's the Mickey Rawlings mystery series by Troy Seuss. The titular character is a journeyman baseball player in the 1910s and 1920s who bounces around from team to team and finds himself involved in murder investigations on a regular basis. Because obviously baseball players are also solving murders. I love it. Oh, this is great. Suzanne also says, this might work for the reader a few episodes ago whose boyfriend wanted Maisie Dobbs but a guy. Alicia says, to the person looking to fill a yellow jacket's shaped hole in their life, We Ride Upon Sticks by Quan Berry. A high school girls field hockey team in late 1980s Massachusetts turns to witchcraft to ensure a winning season. Or do they? And then from Marilyn, for historical baseball fiction, I recommend Joe Harris, The Moon by Joyce A. Miller. It's a historical fiction following the journey of a minor league player who ends up in the 1927 World Series. All right. Cool. Amanda, do you want to read our first question?
Do I ever? Okay, our first question is from Chrissy, who says, my fiance and I are getting married in July. Congratulations. Our honeymoon is going to be a road trip through South Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, and a bit of Idaho. We're going to be mostly checking out national parks and museums. Whenever I go on vacation, I love to try to read or listen to audiobooks about the place we're going. Do you have any good recommendations for books based in this area? They can be fiction, nonfiction, any genre. I love mysteries and family sagas, but have a very open mind. I don't like books where animals are hurt or die, but I get that if it's a book based on a farm or ranch, that can happen. I will throw a book across the room if there is a cancer plot snuck in that isn't mentioned anywhere in the description. I can't stand it when authors think it's a good idea to slip that in when it has nothing to do with the main story. Okay, before we get to that, let's hear from our first sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by Penguin Team. In a world where the children of the gods inherit their powers, a descendant of the Greek Fates must solve a series of impossible murders to save her sisters, her soulmate, and her city. Descendants of the Fates are always born in threes. There's one to weave, one to draw, and one to cut the threads that connect people to the things they love and to life itself. And the Aura sisters are no exceptions. There is Io, the youngest, who uses her fate-born abilities as a private investigator, but her latest job leads her to a horrific discovery. Somebody is abducting women and setting the resulting wraiths loose in the city to kill. Now, the second book in the series, Hearts That Cut, will be on sale June 18th, 2024. This is a must-read for all Greek mythology and fantasy fans. This is dripping with atmosphere, edged with danger. Threads That Bind weaves together a gorgeous dark tapestry of mystery, faded romance, and modern myth. You won't be able to put this one down. And that comes from Alexander Bracken, New York Times bestselling author of Lore. So make sure to pick up Threads That Bind by Kitsa Hatsopoulou. And thanks again to Penguin Teen for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Gallery Books. So Anna Green thought she was marrying Liam West for access to subsidized family housing while at UCLA, which is an interesting reason to marry someone, but you know, in this economy. So anyway, she signed divorce papers when the graduation caps were tossed and she thought she was done. She wasn't. 3 years later, Anna is a starving artist living paycheck to paycheck while West is a Stanford professor. Now he is part of a conglomerate. His family owns this mega grocery store chain. He's not interested in working for them, but he is interested in those greenbacks, honey, that come in the form of a $100 million inheritance. To get it, he has to be married for 5 years. That's where our girl Anna comes back into play. So the two will fake a marriage, but as he gets to know her and gets to appreciate the feisty, foul-mouthed, paint-splattered girl that she is, he'll begin to wonder if the money is worth the love of his life. Pick up The Paradise Problem by Christina Lauren to find out if it is. And thanks again to Gallery Books for sponsoring this episode.
All right, what a fun trip. This sounds very exciting. Mm-hmm. So I picked a book that takes place in South Dakota because that's the first place you mentioned. So that's the first thing I looked up in my like very detailed Goodreads account that has books set in different states and stuff like that. I've like made so many shelves. It's just, it's neurotic, but it's fine. It's very helpful, obviously. So my pick for you is Winter Counts by David Heska Wambly Wyden. And this takes place in South Dakota, as I said, on the Rosebud Indian Reservation, mostly, and then parts of it also take place in Denver. So the main character's name is Virgil, and he is a vigilante, essentially. So, of course, the American justice system has completely abandoned, not has, always had, never unabandoned, was never interested in, and is still not interested in, doing anything that involves finding justice for people who live on reservations. And so when the people who live there can't find justice, when crimes are committed, where they need help in that way from a legal entity, instead of going to the cops, they go to Virgil. And so he will do things like, if your child was assaulted, he will exact justice. And it's not always like, it's not arresting someone. It's like his version of justice. It's quite violent often. This is the thing that he does. Like, people pay him. It's his job. And as the book opens, the reservation in general is starting to have a heroin problem, especially among the teenagers. And the council asks him to do something about it, like to figure out where the drugs are coming from. And he's like not super interested in dealing with this. He doesn't like the council member who asked him to do it. It sounds like, you know, it's outside of the scope of his particular expertise, which is like breaking kneecaps. And he doesn't really care to get involved. But then his nephew, who he is caring for, overdoses and ends up in the hospital. And so now he's like, well, personally invested in this problem and agrees to take it on. So he goes on this road trip with his ex-girlfriend to figure out how these drugs are making their way into the reservation. And that's the mystery that he's solving. It's very like tense and fast paced. I think it makes a great audiobook because it's super, super engaging. It's not, you know, like lighthearted, as you can tell. This isn't like, yay, South Dakota. I mean, it's not Boo South Dakota either, but this is not a book that's going to get you hyped up necessarily about like the landscape or anything. But it is a real slice of life, and it is so engaging, as I said. Compelling, compelling, compelling. So that's Winter Counts by David Heska Wambly Wyden.
Cosine. Hmm. And I've got your lighthearted, parks-focused, entertaining pick. I picked Subpar Parks by Amber Scher because, obviously, I don't know if y'all are familiar with the Instagram account. It's great. Now there's a book. And I'm personally very excited about this one. It is a combination of Cher's illustrations of the different parks, along with those one-star reviews that have made the Instagram so great and popular. But it's also got a bunch of other stuff. It's got more from the author about, like, her relationship with nature and the parks. It's got tips from rangers, which is super cool. Like, if you're gonna go to a bunch of national parks, like, why would you not want the inside scoop from a ranger? Like, that's awesome. And of course, you know, you get all the funny. So I think this is a great book that, like, obviously it's maybe not like a book you're gonna read in the car, but like when you pull over or you're stopping or you're getting ready to go to a specific park, like this is gonna be there for you. And I will never get over the too spiky review of Bryce Canyon.
It is spiky.
Like, I just don't even know what happens to people's brains. Anyway, subpar parks. It's great. There's a book by Amber Cher. That's my rec. Okay. Ooh, our next question is from Molly, who says, queer international horror. I know this is probably out of both of y'all's comfort zones, but I am in a horror book club and we curate themed lists to choose books from. We've had queer horror and international horrors categories, but I want to do a combination of the two, specifically so that I can incorporate The Devourers by Indra Das, which I love. The other books I already have on my list are Something by Ekweka Emezi, just anything, that's it's fair. What Do Nightmares Dream Of, Paradise Rot, and The Root of Ice and Salt. I'd love some more to round out the list. This is, I had not heard of most of these books, side note, which is kind of cool. And yeah, I did go for help for this one, because as you said, it's not exactly my wheelhouse. But I have for you a book that I actually am dying to get. I'm put in a library hold as soon as I found it. It's called A Small Charred Face by Kazuki Sakuraba, and it's translated by Jocelyn Allen. And this is about vampires who are also bamboo, ? Like, super, super interesting premise. There's three different narrators, teenagers, who, and their stories are like separate but linked. It's a linked story set, which I love personally. And what I hear about this book is that it is both deeply messed up and like gorgeous, which is an interesting combination of things. The bamboo, who are the vampires in question, they're from China. They're living in exile in Japan. They live like 100 years. They only feed on the already dead, and like have like this whole very elaborate society. And like one of the boys is a young, his name is Kyo, and his family was murdered by the Yakuza, and he's rescued by one of these bamboo/vampires. And so he's like telling the story. And so there you're getting all of these different ones. And yeah, it just sounds fascinating. Nobody has been specific with me about the deeply messed up parts, so I don't know how I'm going to do, but I'm going to try because it sounds really cool and it seems like a good pick for you. So again, that's A Small Charred Face by Kazuki Sakuraba, translated by Jocelyn Allen. Yeah.
Okay, I picked Jawbone by Monica Odeja, translated by Sarah Booker. This is a new release that just came out this month, and like Jen, I am also on hold for this at the library. I put it on hold because it is not blurbed this way, but it sounds to me like an Ecuadorian Megan Abbott, but more Catholic and more creepy, and I'm very into that. So it's about two girls. So there's like a group of schoolgirls. These are high school students who go to an all-girls school. It's a Catholic school run by Opus Dei, and they are headed up by Fernanda and Annalise, who are their, you know, kind of queen bees. And they spend all of their free time in this like abandoned building that's owned by Fernanda's father. And in that kind of like yellow jackets-y sort of way, that show that was talked about on the show a few weeks ago, the girls in this unsupervised, abandoned setting become completely deranged. there's all of this like overarching Catholic influence on it. So like they set up altars, they develop their own god that they call the White God. So there's a lot of, like, as you can tell, pretty overt colonialist commentary happening here.
Mm.
And the girls are being watched by a teacher who herself is losing her grip on reality and decides that she needs to control the girls in like a really horrifying way. So it's that kind of devolution of the humanity of teenage girls, which I think is always a fascinating thing for authors to take up. Again, Megan Abbott is like the queen of this, but in Ecuador. So, you know, plus Catholicism, plus colonial commentary. So that's Jawbone by Monica Odeja. All right. Question three is from Carol, who says, in the face of the U.S. government's decision to sue Hawaii over the Red Hill fuel tank spill, acting in the interest of the military-industrial complex rather than human rights, I need some fortifying literature. I recently devoured Julian Agwan's The Properties of Perpetual Light, and it completely flipped the bill, somehow managing to soften the sharp edges of the world, even as it inspires you to rage against them. Though mostly prose, the book is deeply poetic, and yet the author brings his lawyer's brain to the party. It does introduce a few social justice issues, but mostly it's not trying to educate or reveal the depth of injustices beyond some personal anecdotes. It just accepts that the reader knows the world is a mess and is looking for a way through. Plus, it was short and broken into bite-sized chunks. What else is out there like this? All right, Jen, what you got?
So I'm going with Incarceration Nation by Baz Dreisinger because I don't know that it's exact. I mean, I haven't read Properties of Perpetual Light, although now I really want to. So you have sold it extremely well. But the vibe that you were talking about, this is the first book I thought of because it is both like, I mean, it's about the prison systems globally, like it's around the world. Like, what are prisons like? And so therefore, it is extremely rage inducing in some. But it also is like weirdly hopeful in that way that you're talking about where it's like, oh, right. Like people are doing things that could help this. Here's some thoughts about what could help. And like, let's think about this together. Like it's that it feels like a calling in, like a here's the information you didn't know you didn't have. And like now, like, let's think about it together. And I do think Dreisinger is a great writer. I think that she brings her own perspective very intelligently to this. And yeah, I mean, she goes to South Africa to work with like to see how they're working with genocide survivors in Rwanda. She goes to Thailand. She goes to Jamaica. She goes to Singapore. She goes to Brazil. Like she goes to Norway. Like it's just she goes everywhere. And there's also so many countries handle this extremely differently, which is not a thing I was really aware of back in, you know, the mid-aughts or whatever, whenever it was that I read the book. And probably wasn't that long ago. It was probably more like 10 years ago, which is bananas to say. But anyway, the point is, I think this is a really useful, smart book. And I do think it will give you the feeling that you're looking for as well. So again, that's Incarceration Nations by Baz Dreisinger.
All right. I picked Weather by Jenny Offal, which is also pretty short. It's about 200 pages. And she is just the reigning champion of really short, punchy, consumable chapters. Her chapters are sometimes not half a page, a few sentences. They're very poetic in that way. I don't know that she's got a background in poetry, but all the books that I've read of hers are like that, like poem-sized chapters. So Weather is about a woman named Lizzie who works as a librarian. And she also has some like family stuff going on. She's a caretaker for her mother and her brother, who is an addict and who has recently become a father. And she's working on her side hustle is working for a woman named Sylvia, who was her mentor and who produces a podcast called Hell in High Water, which is about climate change. And so the job that Lizzie is given is answering, you know, the email and the mail that the podcast gets, which is large. It's a large volume because in the book, this is a really popular show. And so she's answering email and mail letters, both from left wingers who are so caught up in climate anxiety that they can't live their lives, and people on the right who think that the show is a tool of Satan to bring about the end, blah, 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 whatever. Whatever it is, right wing conservative people think. I don't know. And so this is what she does through the whole book. And so the setup is similar to what you were saying, where like, the book is acknowledging that this is happening out in the world, right? Obviously, because it's about a podcast that's about climate change. So it is acknowledging that climate change is happening. It's also acknowledging that people are doing things about it. But like, what do we do at home? Like this character, Lizzie, is caring for her family. She has children. She has a useless husband. She's got little kids. She's got her brother to take care of. You know, she's got all of these plates that are spinning. And like, she's also supposed to go protest outside of Exxon? Like, what are we supposed to actually do about this? Sometimes the answer is like, worry, you know, like question mark, shrug. I don't know. In the moments that you can snatch, what can normal people do? And I think that when you're faced with like news, like you were talking about in your question about the government or the military or some corporation doing something unjust, and that just kind of deflated, defeated feeling that you can, that drives you to literature, I think this is a great place to put that feeling, because she shares that feeling, and she's not sharing it in a like, therefore we should do nothing, or like, therefore all is lost sort of a way. It's just an acknowledgement that like, yeah, that's a sucky feeling. It's a sucky position for normal people to be in. That doesn't mean we get to like wallow in it forever, but like, that's completely real. And I think that's really helpful. So that's Weather by Jenny Offal.
Nice. All right. Our next question is from Alex, who says, I'm looking for a book that follows multiple generations of a family. I love Pachinko and Middlesex and want those same vibes. I love seeing how events in childhood shape the way people behave in their adulthood and the dynamic between multiple generations. If possible, I'd love to find a story centered around a family in the American South. I'll just keep going. I changed my mind like 16 times about this book, but I was trying to find a book that I haven't already talked about a bunch on the show. So I'm going with The 12 Tribes of Hattie by Ayanna Mathis, because this book was like the book for a hot minute there, but I don't feel like people talk about it anymore. And I think it's definitely a book that fits your question. Well, mostly it fits your question. Okay. So before I get into the description, content warnings for child death, addiction, domestic abuse, and homophobia. These characters go through some rough stuff. And this is about a family that is part of the Great Migration. Hattie Shepherd, the Hattie, is 15 years old in 1923. She leaves Georgia and goes to Philadelphia. So this is the part it doesn't exactly fit, because Philadelphia is not the South, but, you know, whatever. Close enough. She goes to Philadelphia to, like, try to have a better life. And she ends up married to a man who, like, is an alcoholic and an addict, and, like, that doesn't work out. She loses her twins in their infancy. But then she has 9 more children, and, like, the story is told in 10 different perspectives. You get, like, the children and then a grandkid, I want to say. So you're getting all of these different perspectives sort of swirling around this one woman who has, like, made this choice and now is trying to make good on it, and how difficult that was, and, like, yeah, how it shapes the generations after. Like, I just think this is the book. This is a book. This is a book that does the thing. So, again, that's The 12 Tribes of Hattie by Ayanna Mathis.
This was harder to find something than I expected. I had my pick in mind, which is The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett, but I went Googling like multi-generational Southern story just to see what the internet would come up with. And when I tell you that everyone says Gone with the Wind and how angry that makes me, because not only is Gone with the Wind, like, you know, whatever, it's Gone with the Wind. We all know the problems with Gone with the Wind. It's not multi-generational. Like, right, that is a book about Scarlett O'Hara. She has parents and she has children, but it is not about, like, you don't switch perspectives. It's just her the whole time.
There aren't that many in the South specifically that are multi-generational.
Yeah.
Like, that was the hard part of this question for me.
Right. And my assumption about, now I'm just apparently TED talking about this, is twofold. It's one, America's a very young country compared to other places that you can get multi-generational stories. But also, you can't tell the story of the South without telling the story of Black people. And Black people don't have historical records going back generations in America a lot of the time. So I guess I get it. But, like, stop recommending Gone with the Wind for this question. It's not the only book that takes place in the South. Anyway, that's my run. So The Vanishing Half is about the Vignage twins, their sisters, who live in a small town in Louisiana. And this little tiny, tiny town is designed, like, planned on purpose to house only light-skinned Black people who can pass. And when the book opens, it's like early in the 20th century. They've done this to give themselves like a place to go because they don't fit in white society or Black society. And since some of them are trying to pass, it's like a place they can hide. And they don't like darker-skinned people coming in. They don't like their kids associating with darker-skinned people. It's like a whole thing. The Vignes twins are light-skinned, just like everybody else who lives there. And they have that itch, you know, they're like 16. They don't like living in this tiny little town where nothing ever happens. And so they decide to leave. They run off together. They go to, I think, New Orleans, and decide that they're going to, like, make their own way. It does not go as planned. One of the sisters gets a job working as a secretary for a company, passing as white. her boss like takes a liking to her. They get together, they get married, and she decides to pass as white for the rest of her life. So she leaves her sister with no warning, goes off and marries this guy, and then pretends to be white forever. And then the other sister does kind of the opposite thing. She marries a very dark-skinned black man who and has a baby who is also dark-skinned. And then she leaves because he is abusive to her. And so she takes her daughter back to her hometown. So the sisters go off on these two converging paths. One of them pretending to be white, moves to California, moves into like a gated community, all of that. And then one of them goes home to this place where her daughter is no longer accepted. And then you switch perspectives to the kids. The daughter of the white passing sister is, you know, has this like whole secret that you're following along, like, is she ever going to find out? And if so, what is she going to do with the information? The darker skinned grandchild knows more. And at the beginning of the book, you get a lot more of their backstory with the twins' parents as well. So it's three generations that you're following here. Trigger warnings for racism, violent racism, and also domestic abuse. The thing that you're really yearning for, I guess, in this entire story is like for these sisters to come back together. Because the big question is like, why didn't you tell me that you were leaving? The sister who stays, who is abandoned is so hurt by that and spends her entire life. Like, why didn't you tell me what happened to you? Are you okay? You know, that whole question. And that question that has reverberating effects both back in time, like to her parents or to her mother, and forward in time to her children and generations beyond that. So like, what effect does lying have on your kids and your kids' kids? It's just big, giant, giant, giant questions that are not specific to the South, but are in a lot of ways in this particular context. So that's The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett. And it is time for our next sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Charming, easygoing, and rich, Xavier Castillo has the world at his fingertips. He also has no interest in taking over his family's empire, but that hasn't stopped women from throwing themselves at him. Unless, of course, the woman in question is his publicist. The cool, the intelligent, the ambitious Sloane Kensington, who is a high-powered publicist who's used to dealing with difficult clients, but none infuriate or tempt her more than a certain billionaire heir with his stupid dimples and laid-back attitude. She may be forced to work with him, but she'll never fall for him because he's a client and that's all he'll ever be, right? Right, girl, like we all know. So just in case you didn't know, author Anna Wong is the best-selling author and book talk viral author of the Twisted Love series, the King of Sin series. Miss Wong got it going on, okay? Make sure to check out King of Sloth by Anna Wong. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high-stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social-climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at LeighBardugoTheFamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode.
Okay, our next question is from Tiffany, who says, on a recent episode, you recommended a book called Honey, Olives, and Octopus that is my almost perfect book. Can you recommend something similar, but with a focus on a place in Latin America, more specifically Central America or the Hispanic Caribbean or East Asia? To be honest, any region outside of Europe is fine. I just need the food culture book fix. The second part of the question is, I love researching, specifically cultural history and methods of historical study, research, and learning. Can you please recommend a book about methodologies of historical research or something that's sideways that can give me a new perspective on the research process in a social sciences type of field? Okay, Jen, what you got?
All right, this is from my TBR. I also love a food memoir, and this is A Tiger in the Kitchen, A Memoir of Food and Family by Cheryl Lutien Tan. And Cheryl grew up in Singapore and then moved to America at 18. She is like very, she's like rebel child. Mm. But then when she's in her 30s in New York, she's like a fashion writer. She's successful, but she's feeling like she wants to reconnect with her childhood and specifically the Singaporean dishes that are from her childhood. So she's like, can I go back and like learn how to make these dishes? Like, does anybody remember? Plus, there's a lot of family history that she just like sort of didn't want anything to do with when she was younger. But now that she's getting older, is more interested in. So you're getting this sort of personal tour of what it means to leave and then go back, the food, like the family stuff. Ugh, like this is the combination that I like live for. It's got 10 recipes also, and they list pineapple tarts as one of them. And I'm just like, I could not be more here for that. Like, give me all of the pineapple things. So I'm just really excited to get into this one, and I thought you might be too. Again, that's A Tiger in the Kitchen, A Memoir of Food and Family by Cheryl Lutien Tan.
Okay, I took the history research question, and I think what you're asking about is historiography, which I had to pull deep out of my history college brain. So the study of history and historical methods and the history of history is called historiography. So you're looking for a book about historiography. There are tons of like textbooks, and some of which I read in college that I really enjoy that you can go read. But I'm not going to recommend any of those because I don't want to recommend a textbook. That seems kind of boring. So I came at this question sideways, and I'm recommending Women in Power by Mary Beard. Mary Beard is a very well-known professor of the classics at Cambridge. She's like not just famous in academic circles. She's kind of internet famous also because she writes a lot about Greece and Rome and the women of those time periods, ancient Greece, ancient Rome. And because of that, she gets trolled a lot on Twitter, which is just the most, what? Like, you're trolling this professor because she talks about Sappho. Like, it's just, get a hobby. But it's so bad. She's gotten so much pushback and vitriol and threats that she wrote this book, Women in Power, which is a little bit about her experience being a powerful academic and the immediate backlash that she got about it, and then also actual women from history. So she goes back all the way back to like the Odyssey and how women are portrayed in the Odyssey to up through present day. She talks a little bit about like Medusa and Hillary Clinton. There's a little bit about Elizabeth Warren. So modern history, very contemporary, like pretty recent, all the way back to Homer. And the reason why I think this is a good pick for historiography kind of questions is because she's talking about the history of history. And the history of history is that we don't talk about the women. The history of history is that we ignore the way that women are portrayed in both historical documents and in things like the Odyssey, which you can view as a historical document of sorts. And we just like completely map our current thinking about the role of women onto those documents and stories and evidence in order to make the narrative fit the what we think that it should fit. And not necessarily what, like, you as a reader think how you think it should fit, but, like, how old white men who have been in charge of the narrative of history forever think that women should fit into the historical narrative. So it's a big historiographical question of how women are portrayed in history and the research methods, which are usually quite flawed, that get us to this place where we're ignoring women or putting them or removing them from their places of power and ignoring their voices and all of that. So it's a pretty slim book. It's a little over 100 pages, but I think it's a good start for a question like this. So that's Women and Power by Mary Beard.
Love a historiography soapbox. It's great. Speaking of our wheelhouses. Okay, so our next question is from Caroline, who says, I'm looking for a novel with a realistic small town as the setting. Specifically, I would like a book set in a small town with tourist traffic that isn't about the tourists. So many books lean too hard into the everything is perfect in a small town, or the seedy underbelly is taking over, or recently divorced/widowed person randomly moves in and rediscovers love and meaning of life, or just city people getting out of their element in general. I grew up in a small town, and I'm much more interested in the getting by of the locals. The guys serving tourist drinks, the teenage girl selling cheap souvenirs as a summer job, the woman watering the flower beds. Bonus points for being set at a beach, the main characters being in their 20s to 30s and knowing there's a world outside the town, and or characters that are deeply average and relatable, preferably not a murder mystery / traumatic crime focus. Carolyn, you cracked me up with this question. And I feel your rant. It's great. So I picked Ramona Blue by Julia Murphy, which I think hits almost all of your points. It is about teenagers, but it's about a teenager who's about to like head out into the world. It's like older YA, and I think you're going to love it because it is, it so exactly captures what you are talking about. Ramona is, she lives in Eulogy, Mississippi, and it is like a summer like destination for a lot of people, but she's lived there all her life. And they lost their home in Hurricane Katrina when she was 5, and they have not really recovered. There has just not been, they haven't had the resources to really put their lives back together. So they're living in a trailer. She is going to school and working multiple jobs. Her parents are separated. Her mom is, you know, struggling with addiction, is pretty flaky. And her dad is just like, so he's doing his best, but it leaves a lot of room. And her older sister is pregnant and her boyfriend is like living with them. So it's like a lot of home stuff going on. And there's also a sort of really interesting like coming of age moment. Her best friend from childhood, Freddie, has been like not around for a long time, but he comes back. And he is a competitive swimmer, and he like talks her into swimming with him. And they also start to have a little, like their friendship starts to turn into a little more romantic, which is very confusing for Ramona because she has felt very strongly that she is a lesbian. Like she is very interested. She's dated girls. Like this is what she is. This is who she is. But now she's having feelings for this guy and she like really feels weird about it in all of the ways that I think a lot of people who discover they are bisexual or pansexual after having had a queer awakening, it is extremely confusing. Mm-hmm. And that's what she's struggling with. On top of, you know, being like from the lower class, like dealing with all this family stuff, having to work a lot of jobs and try to go to school and figure out like, can she have a life outside of this town is a huge question for her. And I freaking love this book so much. It just digs into so many feelings that I think a lot of people have trouble articulating or like have not seen on the page before. And it's just a really, it's a great story. And yeah, you'll get what you're looking for. So again, that's Ramona Blue by Julie Murphy.
Okay, forgive me. This is a holiday book, but it's so perfect. It's so perfect. So I picked The Holiday Switch by Tiff Marcello, who, side note, is amazing. She's a Filipino writer. She was like, she's an army veteran. She's a nurse. She's just like all the things. She's such a badass. So this is a YA novel also, and it takes place in this tiny little town in New York, in like upstate New York in the Finger Lakes kind of area. And this town is most famous for being the setting of a really well-known Christmas movie. So every year, the tourists, like, flock to this movie to get memorabilia and take pictures and all of that. And you mentioned the teenage girl selling cheap souvenirs as a summer job. This book is about exactly that person. Lila Castro is a Filipino-American. She lives with her family in this town. They've lived there her whole life. Her mom is a nurse at the local hospital, and her dad runs a small business. She's got, three siblings. And it's just like very normal. She absolutely knows that there's a world outside of her little town. She wants to go to medical school when the book opens. She's also a book blogger in the book, so it's like quite meta. And she loves her home. Like it's not a novel about a small town girl wants to get away because everything is terrible. It's also not perfect. Like her family experienced an accident, like some property damage to her dad's business, and they started to GoFundMe, which some of the locals did not like. They got doxxed. They were harassed. Like there is, it's not a seedy underbelly, but like sometimes people are mean, you know, and especially in a small town where everybody knows your business and everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people can be really judgmental. Just like anywhere else, there are good and bad things about living in a small town. I'm from rural Virginia, so I love a small town novel, but I don't like it when it's just like this is Stars Hollow. No.
Right.
It's a Dollar General and a check cashing place and like people judging your choices, but also, you know, nature, like there's a good and a bad. And I think this book really captures that. She deeply, really, like Lila really, really genuinely likes the reasons why people come to her town. She appreciates the tourists. She likes her job because she likes the movie that they're coming to, like, that the fans are coming to appreciate. And she wants to, like, earn money to go to medical school and help her parents. The town and its, like, side characters are quite close-knit. Not everybody, because, again, some people are just mean. But, like, the community that her and her family have created in this little town is really genuine and sweet and awesome. So Yeah, it's not about the tourists. I mean, the tourists come and then leave, as they often do. But it's just about this girl and her family and her group of friends and neighbors just kind of getting by. Like, they're very average, normal, middle-class folk, hardworking people. So that's The Holiday Switch by Tiff Marcello. All right. Our last question is from Fat, who says, I recently read the Hell's Library series, and I'm intrigued to see books like this, about words, stories, and how we interact and explore them. I've had Strange the Dreamer, Muse of Nightmare, and the Wayward Children series on my TBR, so I'd like books other than that. Thank you. Okay, Jen, your last pick.
It's me. Okay, my pick, this is, I'm reading this right now, and I am super enjoying it. It's The Reader by Tracy Chi, which is actually the first in a series, which is always exciting. New series is on my jam. And this is, there are tons of books about books out there, especially in fantasy land, like words have power, et cetera, et cetera. And it's an amazing trope. But what I like about The Reader as I'm reading it, is that it's coming at it from a different angle. So in this world, like, reading is not a thing. Like, books are not a thing. Writing, literacy is not a thing. Sophia is the main character, and she... Oh, right. Content warning before I get into this. Violent harm to children. Like, in the way that so much of YA is about kids experiencing harm, like, that's what this is. Sophia is the daughter of two people who, like, you know, she grew up knowing that they were in hiding, is how I'm going to say this. And her mother dies of an illness, and then her father is, like, brutally murdered over the thing that they're hiding, which she knows, she, like, has seen it. She has held it in her hands. It's this, like, square that's, like, covered. There's some paper in it. Like, she doesn't know what it is, but she has seen it. She knows only that her parents have, like, basically died to keep it from people. And she's taken by her aunt. They are on the run. And, like, they're, like, you know, thieving their way around this world. And she only knows that she has to stay in hiding. That's all she really knows. And then Nin is taken from her. She's not sure if she's still alive or dead. Like, it's very traumatic circumstances. She feels like it's her fault. And she ends up on this quest to try to get Nin back. And she starts to understand that this is a book, and that words are powerful. And it's, like, a really fascinating look at, like, how you approach that when you're coming from a place of no knowledge. And also the way that anything can be a book is one of my favorite threads of this story, is, like, seeing the world around you and seeing all the ways in which, if you're not, like, sort of stuck in a specific way that you think about words and books, like, anything can be a book. Like, ugh, I love that. Anyway, so there's action, there's, you know, there's a budding romance, like, there's all kinds of stuff going on, and I think it will give you the vibes from a different angle. So again, that's The Reader by Tracy Chi.
All right. I picked the Invisible Library series by Genevieve Cogman, of which there are, like, a floppity jillion. I think there are, like, 12. So you will never run out of supernatural, booky, fantasy stuff happening. So it's about a woman named Irene, who is a spy for the mysterious Library with a capital L. The Library with a capital L exists between worlds and dimensions, and their job is to preserve books from every world and dimension, some of which exist across, you know, like, there are copies of Persuasion by Jane Austen in every world and dimension, but they might have different endings, or they might have different beginnings, or whatever. And so the Library houses a copy of all of those things. So it turns into this, like, all of the known knowledge in all of the world and all of the worlds beyond the world exists in one place. And her job is to go to these different realities and get copies of books for the Library. She gets assigned a new assistant named Kai, who's, like, really cute, but also has a lot of secrets and does not talk a lot. And their job is to go to an alternative kind of steampunky version of London to get a book. And not just any book, but, like, a really dangerous book that a lot of people have been after and that no one's been able to get. But when they get there, it's already been stolen by somebody. And a bunch of different, like, underground seedy groups in this alternative London are after it and are after her. And to add another wrinkle, the world is infested by chaos, which in this universe, or the universe of this kind of book, means that unnatural, quote-unquote, creatures have invaded. So there's, like, vampires and werewolves and things. And they can bend the rules of magic how they see fit in order to do whatever vampire-y and werewolf-y thing they want to be doing in any given moment. So the rules that she's used to obeying in a magical universe don't really apply so much. So she's kind of already off her footing. The thing that her assignment is going awry. Her assistant, again, is very cute and, again, has many secrets. Is cute, has secrets. That's a whole trope.
That's our show title. Yeah.
And so immediately she's just like, secret societies, danger, vampires be vampiring, who is my assistant, where is the book? And she has a nemesis who shows up in the middle of book one to make all this complicated stuff even more complicated. So there's a lot of adventure. The steampunky elements are really cool. There's a lot of like fights on what are the not umbrellas, balloons, hot air balloons. A thing that goes over your head. I don't know. And it's just really like fun and lighthearted and adventure-y. And there are many pages, which seems to be what you're after. So that's the Invisible Library series by Genevieve Cogman.
I feel like I misspoke earlier. So just to correct, the Tracy Chi is the start of a trilogy that is all out. It's new to me, but mm-hmm. it's not new to the world. It's mm-hmm. all, the trilogy is complete. It's out in the world. Okay. On that note, we did it. We did the show. Here we are. Thanks so much to our audio editor, Jen Zink. Thank you all for listening. If you would like more book recommendations, you can check them out at bookriot.com. You can find our other podcasts at bookriot.com/listen. You could leave us a rating and or a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and Podchaser. So many places for you to leave us ratings and reviews. It helps other people to find the show. Thank you to our sponsors for making the show possible. Amanda, where can people find you in between the shows?
On Instagram at I'm Amanda Nelson.
And you can find me on Twitter and Tumblr as Jen IRL, J-E-N-N-I-R-L, or on Instagram as I am Jen IRL. And we will talk to you next time.